Hello, and welcome to Viewpoints, a weekly program of information on the ever-changing world of accessibility. Now here are the hosts of this program, Nancy Goodman-Torpy and Peter Torpy.
Hello, I'm Nancy.
And I'm Pete. And on this week's show, we'll be talking about canoeing through the Florida jungles. And this is a follow-up with Jose Tamayo, who we heard in show 1150, when he started thinking about this canoe trip.
But first, for our tip of the week. This week's tip is plan ahead, but expect to need to make changes in your plans.
Well, fortunately, Jose on this trip did plan ahead. But as we'll see as we follow him through his 5-day, 65-mile canoe trip, there were a few unexpected things that happened, and it was a good thing they had prepared. This is a pretty exciting story, so I think you'll be interested to follow his adventures through the jungle here.
It was also a good thing that not only Jose, but all of his friends who were on the trip with him were able to pretty much roll with all the punches. So they did a great job of planning. They thought they had it all planned. And then when changes happened, they just figured out what to do with all of the changes.
See, one day I breathe, I breathe, I breathe, I breathe like you. See, one day I breathe, I breathe, I breathe, I breathe like you.
Now that's not our usual breaker tune. That's a tune called Breathe, written by Matt Scales, who was afflicted with cystic fibrosis. And it's become kind of a theme song for people with cystic fibrosis. And it gives them hope, and they use it for all sorts of events related to cystic fibrosis. And this trip was intended to raise awareness of cystic fibrosis and also to raise money to fund research for cystic fibrosis, and hence the tune. Turning now to our low-tech item, we'll reintroduce Jose Tamayo. He was on this show in number 1150, as we mentioned, describing what was then his upcoming canoe trip. And again, in show 1213, talking about an accessible home entertainment system using the Apple TV.
I'm Jose Tamayo.
Just to remind our listeners, you are visually impaired.
I only have light perception now. I lost my sight around 8 years ago, totally. I used to drive. I drove until I was about 33 years old.
That was due to glaucoma?
Retinitis pigmentosa.
We originally met Jose because I've interacted with him on a number of JAWS issues. And it's been fascinating to me to see some of the different types of things he's gotten involved in as a visually impaired person and some of the challenges that he's been able to overcome. In particular, this canoe trip, boy, I wouldn't do it even if I was sighted going through the jungles of Florida with the bugs and alligators and the heat and, you'll see there was much more.
Well, different people have different ideas of what's fun, and this is one of the things that Jose enjoys. And here's how he got into doing some of these extreme sports in the first place.
I used to be the president of a computer science club at the college that I used to attend. This is when I had most of my sight. We used to take excursions to many, many different places. And then one day we decided, hey, why don't we try some of the extreme sports in the area? And we found this place up in Arcadia, Florida, that allowed us to do that. And so what we did is we took a group up there of about 30 people to experience that. And our very first trip was in 1991, and it was a 37-mile paddling trip down the river, 2 people per canoe, and it was extremely fun. It was something that I enjoyed doing the first time, and I've been doing it ever since. It is out in the jungle. There's no civilization, and you get to interact with many species of wildlife. You know, alligators and I guess panthers and black bear and bobcats and, you know, and anything you can imagine out there, it's out there.
Well, I don't know that I'd like to interact with just about any species. I was thinking more like dogs and cats. They would be fun to interact with, but I don't know about the alligators and panthers.
I don't think you're likely to find a lot of dogs and cats in the jungle, except for some of those large cats that he mentioned.
But clearly, Jose has been doing this for a long time, so he is well-skilled at this, well-prepared, and, you know, has developed a lot of the skills and experience to go along with these extreme trips through the jungle over a period of time.
And he always goes with members of the same group, so a lot of them are experienced in doing this trip as well.
Well, that certainly helps. I mean, we've done canoe trips ourselves with our family, but Nothing quite this adventuresome.
You are listening to Viewpoints.
For this week's focus topic, let's hear the story of Jose's remarkable adventure down the river through the Florida jungle. As you'll hear, it was even more exciting and eventful than anticipated.
We're expecting to hear some great stories today.
Oh, yeah, right?
Do you want to start with the good news or the cracked ribs?
Oh, my goodness. There's always something that we learn from these trips. And, you know, we've never had injuries because we're very, very, very careful. But this time, there were a couple of people that got hurt.
What happened?
No big deal. I had two fractured ribs from day one, and I didn't know it. I just kept on with the pain, and I just kept on carrying logs and paddling and dragging. And somebody else fell off the canoe. They have a huge bruise. But that's, the worst was me.
No big deal. I'm just amazed how nonchalant he is about having the cracked ribs. I had some ribs that were bruised, not quite cracked once. And let me tell you, they're quite painful. And I've heard that cracked ribs are even more painful. And I can't imagine doing that when you have to do all this paddling and strenuous exercise in addition.
But sometimes it helps not knowing how badly you're injured.
Actually, he indicated that, you know, I guess when you're exercising, a lot of the endorphins are pumping, and sometimes that can alleviate some of the discomfort that you might be otherwise feeling.
So he had talked about this trip that he was planning to take in show 1150, as we've mentioned, about 6 months ago. And at the end of that show, we told him we'd check back with him after it was over. So we did.
So on our previous show, you were talking about the 65-mile canoe trip you were setting up as a fundraiser to raise money for cystic fibrosis, which your daughter has. And so we're calling you back to see how that trip went.
The trip went great. We were hoping that the river would not be as low as it was. They were showing water levels at 0.78 foot in some places. My canoe outfitter told me that this is the lowest he's ever seen the river in his lifetime in Arcadia. And our first leg of the trip, when we got to the canoe outfitter, and the guy told us there's a quarter mile of no water when you pass the first bridge. And let me tell you a little bit about the first bridge. The first bridge is about 12 miles from where we start. He told us, well, we can take you up there and you guys can suffer through it, but you guys are carrying a bunch of stuff and you're going to be dragging most of the first 12 miles. And then after the bridge, you're going to be dragging over complete sand for a quarter mile. There's no water there. We said, okay, no problem. We'll start down there midway and then we'll paddle up. And that's what we did. We started at Gardiner and we paddled up all the way up to the bridge. And sure enough, there was no water there.
It must have been a little bit of a surprise. For our international listeners, Jose talked about there being not much water in the river where he was supposedly canoeing. And we're talking about a quarter of a meter here.
Now, if you've not done much canoeing, canoeing in deep water is a piece of cake. I mean, maybe not for 65 miles at a pop, but canoeing in deep water is fairly straightforward. The shallower the water gets, once it gets below maybe a few feet or a meter where you can't put the paddle all the way in, that starts to involve some different shoulder muscles than maybe you were planning on using, and that can get very tiring. And then if you have so little water that you have to get out of the boat and drag it, well, that's harder work still. So we were pretty impressed with the original plan of paddling 65 miles in what everybody expected to be water that was deep enough to paddle through. Well, they planned on paddling 65 miles. Let's see what happened.
I would say that the paddling was about 40% of the time. The other time we had to get off because there were some areas where the water was underfoot and we had to pull the canoes across about water up to the ankles. That's it.
That must have been tough work.
It was tough work because we had to tie ropes to the top, to the front of the canoes, and we ended up pulling across. And you must imagine, I mean, we had to get off the canoe and then get in the front of it and pull it across these dry areas. And a lot of legwork.
We had to portage a canoe once with the kids when we were canoeing down some river and had to bypass the rapids. And so we had to carry our canoe and all our equipment around the rapids on land. And That is not easy. Well, especially the kids weren't very helpful at the time, but it's still a lot of work.
And that was only a couple hundred feet, and we had nowhere near the amount of stuff in the canoes that they did. So this trip started on a Wednesday, and it wasn't long before they had their first unplanned incident.
On Wednesday, we started off around 10 a.m., and we paddled up about 5 or 6 hours. Paddled, walk, you know, dragging. We decided to stop. We found this nice campsite. So we were camping out, and we're gathering wood for the fire, the campfire. And me and my brother-in-law were going down this hill, and it was muddy. He slipped off, and so did I. I usually carry a stick with me, but I couldn't find one that time. And that usually keeps me out of danger. But when I slipped off, I went down the hill and landed on a tree stump that was upright. And took the wind out of me for a few minutes. And then I felt okay, but there was some pain there on my left side. So I just kept going. We kept carrying the wood. But it was, I would say, bearable. The pain was bearable. But I was on medication most of the time. You know, Tylenol.
I was going to say, you must be tough. I've heard that cracked ribs can be very painful.
It was. It's an interesting experience. I've never had a cracked bone in my life, but this one was, the breathing was very difficult.
And of course, you were exerting yourself the whole rest of the week, so it must have been very hard.
I kept paddling, and I kept carrying logs and swimming across the river. It was, in some areas, going out to get wood. It was, I just kept doing what I had to do, but I sort of ignored the pain until nighttime, because nighttime was tough, because the minute I tried to lay down, laying down was the most difficult part.
Well, good thing there were no physicians around to tell Jose that he ought to just rest and give up the rest of the trip. But it sounds like, you know, he was quite ambitious and, you know, was just going to do what he wanted to do, and that's quite admirable.
While he was on the trip, he kept an audio diary and posted regular updates. Here's an early one.
Today is April 5th, 2012. We're actually en route, still paddling, and left camp a little while ago. Water is really low, and still like yesterday, all dragging, a lot of walking. Most of the time, we spent a lot of time, I'd say 50, 60% of the time, dragging our canoes, getting off. And we're moving forward, checking out.
So there you go. He made it possible for everybody to follow him as he went through the trip, and now he has a good record himself to follow and remember some of these wonderful events.
So besides the cracked ribs and his brother-in-law's bruises, as the trip went on, they ran into some other problems as well.
We ran out of water, and we forgot to bring 2 jugs of water that we were supposed to take with us, but it was tough because the sun was beating down really hard, and it was 12 of us, and there was 1 jug of water left.
You don't want to run out of water when it's so hot. I mean, the sun is really intense down there. And especially when you have to exert yourself, you wind up needing even more water. So I thought that was a very difficult thing that they had to get through.
Right. They were trying to avoid filtering the water or using iodine tablets. And so they had planned on bringing enough water for everybody to drink. But as he said, they forgot a couple of jugs. And come the last night when they were running out of water and they still had, I don't know how many miles left to go, they were pretty sorry that they had forgotten those last couple of jugs. But they got creative, and I believe they melted some ice from the cooler that they still had, and that was clean water, and they figured out some other ways of using the sun to overheat some river water, and they actually were able to generate enough water. But I think next time they'll bring one of those filtration systems and try something different.
Yeah, the other thing that I thought was interesting, I mean, carrying water for 5 days for all those people had to really add to their load, which if you were actually canoeing down the river, that wouldn't be so bad because you more or less float down the river. But all that extra weight, they wound up carrying it when the river wasn't deep enough to actually canoe. So that had to be very difficult and just add to all the stress.
Boy, I'll bet. Fortunately, they had all been training physically for months to prepare for this trip and building up their muscles, and so that gave them a lot of extra strength that they might not otherwise have had. It paid off, sorta.
Well, I guess all this training really paid off, though. I mean, you started out in very good shape. You talked about in our last show about all the training you were doing to get ready for this trip.
I never felt any muscle strain, but I do have to tell you that I would have liked for next time, under these conditions, we have to get a lot more work on our legs because we never expect to have to walk.
So that was the really funny thing, that after this canoe trip that everybody had prepared for and made sure they were in great shape for, of course, you mostly focus on, you know, aerobically what kind of shape you're in and your arm strength and back strength. And of course, because they had to carry the canoe so often with all that weight in it, their legs wound up very sore. And you usually don't think of that as being one of the side effects of canoeing.
But they kept plugging along. It's not like they stopped just because they were getting sore and tired.
Of course, there was no place they could get off in the middle of the river, so once they started this venture, there are some things you just have to complete.
Jose was the organizer of the trip, the leader of the trip, and was also the only blind person on the trip.
So how was it being the only visually impaired person on the trip? Was it a special challenge for you, or were you helpful in some ways at night that other people couldn't be?
Well, I'm going to tell you, I'm very independent. What I did is I know that out there are lots of thorns, and so I'm always walking around with a towel around my head when I'm looking for wood, because I did pinch my eye on one of those occasions when we were looking for wood, but I cover my face because I like to get out and look for wood and get the camp ready, and I'm able to do most things. I just need a little bit of direction sometimes, so I'll just lift my hand up and, hey, can you guys help me out? Which way is the river? And they'll just tell me straight or left or right. And if I have my stick with me, I can get around pretty much anywhere, because I like to discover. I like to get around the camp and know where I'm sitting and where everything is situated, so that way I don't have to be asking, hey, can you get me this? Hey, can you get me that? Because I like to be independent, and I do set up my own tent, and I help set up the other tents as well.
You know, it's interesting you talk about, your friends giving you directions out in the woods as you're looking for firewood. I get very disoriented in our backyard in the woods when I do, for instance, raking of leaves in the fall.
Yes.
I tend to lose track of which direction I'm pushing the leaves and all.
I use spatial orientation. Often people look at me and they say, what are you doing? Why are you looking around so much? And I am listening. Just for things. When we set up camp, I tend to stand around and sort of, it looks like I'm looking around, but what I'm doing is I'm listening and I'm trying to figure out where everything is. Once I do that, I can pretty much get around as long as I have a stick with me. I can get around because I really don't want to fall and get hurt like I did this time. But I try to keep my direction and I know, try to stay aware of where everything is.
Right. So you're aware of the sounds around you, where the wind is coming from, and that orients you, I guess.
Yes, in fact, people usually ask me, where should we set up the fire? Which way is the wind going? And I say, well, you don't know that? And I say, no, just tell me where to set up the fire, because we don't know where the wind is coming from. And I just tell them, it's going east or it's going west, and you guys should set it up on this side. That's what we usually do.
No one else takes notice of those things, but you need to.
Yeah. When I lost my sight, I had to learn all of that.
So even though Jose is visually impaired, you can see that he's a fully contributing member of the team that it was doing the trip. You know, and also in many cases, he has some skills that actually complement the other skills that team members might have. So working in a team is a good thing.
So I gather there wasn't enough water for there to be any alligators in the river. Were there any dangerous animals on the shore?
We saw one gator at night.
Where?
We saw him in our last campsite at night. It was Saturday night. We were sitting out there at the camp. And I say to these guys, hey, I heard something. And my brother-in-law says, hey, guys, if Jose heard something, there's something out there. So we all get up and we start walking around. And they're imagining it's pitch dark out here. And they went out there and there was a gator by the canoes out there. There he's just sitting out there waiting, just relaxing.
So what I'll do you bet you were relaxing, too, once you detected the alligator.
Oh, everybody was alert. Everybody was alert.
What do you do at that point? You just keep an eye on it?
They don't bother anybody. We just stay where we are. But usually they rely on me for listening out for things like that.
Yeah, just an alligator. They don't bother anybody.
Yeah, well, the alligator didn't bother anybody, but that wasn't the worst nocturnal experience they had.
We had some stalkers on Saturday night.
People or four-legged?
People. this is one time where we learned that we're always looking out for nature and wildlife, but we learned this time that we have to look out for people too. We had a couple of people in a pickup truck that were watching us all night. And at one point they got off to come toward the camp, but we all got out of our tents and made some noises and they left really quickly. It was scary.
Wow, that can be more scary than the animals, I would guess.
They watched us until 4:30 in the morning. They kept passing by every hour on the hour exactly watching us.
Wow, that is so creepy.
Yeah, we don't know what they were planning, but we were alert. We were awake. We weren't sleeping that night. So that made it for a tough Sunday, because Sunday we were really tired. Everybody was really tired. I didn't feel anything other than the pain in my ribs, but everybody else was exhausted.
Boy, as if it wasn't enough to contend with nature and the low water and the broken ribs, they had to deal with other people scaring them in the woods. That must not have been fun.
But besides being determined enough to finish this canoe paddle with the cracked ribs and all the other problems, Jose came out of it with a really positive attitude and took home the message that there's a lesson to be learned in any experience.
You know, Pete and Nancy, I've never had an experience where we've had stalkers. This was the very first time. And it teaches us a lesson. I think it reinforces what I've already been telling people. Because you know what happens year after year that people go there? They tend to get comfortable and they tend to think, oh, nothing's going to happen. But when you are not on the guard, that's when things really happen. And I took the opportunity to tell everybody, look, you see why we have to be alert, why we have to clean the camp. Because today it was a group of people that were, I don't know what they were up to, but tomorrow we're not being careful enough and it could be a bear in our camp because we have food thrown all over the floor or because we didn't take care because we got really comfortable. So the minute you get comfortable and you stop watching is when things really begin to occur.
Well, as Jose said, you do have to be very aware and plan ahead, and that really helps you avoid disasters. And although they ran into many misadventures here, you can see that their planning ahead and just their training paid off to help them get through all these trials and tribulations. And eventually they had a great time and some great experiences to remember. In fact, I think he's doing another trip in July. Not quite this long, right?
Not quite this long, but it's likely to be hotter. Hopefully they have more water because that would be a drag if they had to pull the canoes the whole way again. So they finally finished the trip, and they had good reason to celebrate. Quite an accomplishment.
We got there around 4:30 in the afternoon on Sunday, and usually a celebration is everybody starts yelling and congratulating each other, and the pictures, and there's a big bell at the end there that we all ring. Everybody goes out to that bell, and they ring the bell, and it becomes like a big celebration, and then we go get some boiled peanuts.
Boiled peanuts.
Well, you know how to have a good time.
That sounds like a great celebration. And maybe after we finish this show here, we'll go out and get some boiled peanuts and celebrate with him.
Works for me. That was another clip from Breathe by Matt Scales. Now for this week's high-tech item, how Jose documented the trip and stayed in communication while he was on the trip. As we've mentioned before, Jose is a team player, and he was willing to do whatever needed to get done, including some stuff you might not have expected.
You talked about taking your own pictures. Do you have a special technique for taking pictures?
What I usually do is I point the phone because it's got that camera on the top right side. I just try to keep it level to the ground. And I don't know, I just point, I just make sure that it stays level. And I try to follow the voices. It's all, I think, spatial orientation. I've learned to sort of tell where people are.
See, when Pete takes pictures of me and we're out in front of some pretty scenery, rather than saying cheese, I just keep saying here, here, here. And then he aims for the voice, and I usually set him up so that he's got lots of, what do I want to say? I mean, I'm a pretty small piece in this picture. And if I get into the picture somewhere, then after the fact, I can crop because we have lots of bits.
I usually take three or four.
Well, I was going to say, I take a billion pictures too. And then she can pick out the one that came out best.
Yeah. And that works out too.
That's
works
right. Out. So that's one of the great things about digital cameras. As I keep telling people, electrons are cheap and memory's cheap, so I can just take lots of pictures and just hope one of them comes out, and usually Nancy gets a pretty good one.
Some of them come out quite good. All our friends are surprised when they see a picture of me from vacation. They're like, who took that? And I said, well, Pete did.
I don't think it's anything I'll make a career out of.
Jose and his friends had brought along lots of high-tech gadgets with them. But of course, as you can expect, they ran into unexpected problems with their high-tech gadgets also.
So you also talked about in our last show that during the trip, you were going to try to keep in contact with the rest of the world through Twitter and video feeds, and you were taking along some high-tech, you know, gear like iPhones.
Right.
How did that all work out?
Well, it worked out really great because we took some video, and we took over 300 pictures. The issue is that I've got so many pictures. My sister is helping me with figuring out what the picture has. And I took my own solar charger, but we had some issues with those. But at one point, they stopped functioning for us. And I think it was the amount of heat out there.
Oh.
These things can't be under more than 120 degrees. And direct sunlight can sometimes get these devices really hot. And I think they stopped functioning because of that.
So you had your iPhone for yourself then, I presume?
Yes.
That worked out okay for you?
I took lots of pictures. We all lost signal the last 2 days. And there's an area there where there was no signal for anyone. And we made sure we had a few different companies.
So that's great when a solar charging device doesn't work in the hot sun. I can't imagine.
Well, and they were careful to have all those different carriers so they'd get the maximum coverage with their cell phones. And that wasn't sufficient preparation. But for future trips, Jose is getting training in using a ham radio. So maybe that'll help with their emergency communications if it's necessary.
Yeah, technologies aren't always perfect. They have their intrinsic problems also.
And even though he wasn't able to post all of the pictures and videos and stuff while they were still on the trip, by now he's got it all posted. And if you want to see the pictures or the video or listen to the narrative or whatever, here's where it is.
www.paddle4cf.com, and four is F-O-R, so P-A-D-D-L-E-F-O-R-C-F.com, and then on Facebook is facebook.com/paddle4cf, and then Twitter @paddle4cf. My YouTube page is the same thing. YouTube, just do a search for paddle4cf.
And in case people didn't catch all that,
all of those links will be in the show notes, which you can find at our website, www.viewpointsplus.net. That's it for show 1221.
Next week, we'll be talking about Orca, O-R-C-A, which is a screen reader for the Linux operating system. We'll also be talking about the GNOME desktop, which is also part of Linux and was made to be accessible.
We'll be talking with Joni Diggs and Alejandro Pinheiro Iglesias, who are two of the developers of Orca and GNOME. If you have any questions regarding something you've heard about on the show, or you'd like to share an idea for a future show, send an email to contact@viewpointsplus.net or call us at 585-258-0333, and we'll try to address your question in an upcoming program.
You've been listening to Viewpoints, hosted and produced by Nancy Goodman-Torpey and Peter Torpey in partnership with WXXI Reach Out Radio. For detailed information or a full archive of programs, visit www.viewpointsplus.net. You can also follow us on Facebook or Twitter @ViewpointsPlus. We hope you'll join us again next week for more information and updates on products for accessible living. Thanks for listening to Viewpoints, and have a nice day. Thank you.